What is God calling you to do? What is the one thing you were born to do? Are you truly doing what you're called to do? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or learn more about Callings for Life at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose. The story of Michael Hixon is truly tragic. Tragic in more ways than one. He is numbered among those who at least reportedly died of COVID, but what actually killed him is bad medical ethics, unethical medicine. Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to talk about the quality of life ethic in healthcare that ultimately killed this man, Michael Hixon, and we'll talk about the ethics of blocking puberty in transgendered children. Joining us to do so, Wesley Smith. He's senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism, attorney and consultant to the Patients' Rights Council, columnist for National Review Online, and author of several books, including Culture of Death, The Age of Do Harm Medicine. Wesley, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. How are you?
Doing well. Tell us the tragic story of Michael Hixon.
Yeah, this is really awful, and it really exposes the danger of the quality of life ethic that is poisoning our healthcare system thanks to the bioethics movement. Michael was had a cardiac arrest back in 2017, and he had a terrible brain injury that resulted from that. He was quadriplegic, cognitively disabled, but he was not unconscious in the way that Terry Schiavo was alleged to have been. He came down with COVID, and he was able to breathe on his own, and his wife, who did not have the right to make his medical decisions because of a conflict she had with her sister-in-law at the time, so an agency had temporary guardianship at this time. She told the doctor she wanted him to receive treatment. She did not want him intubated, but that she wanted the kind of normal treatment people would receive, medications and so forth. And the doctor said, no, we're not going to do that because of his it will not improve his quality of life. In other words, the doctor wasn't saying the treatment wouldn't save his life. He was saying, well, what's the point of saving his life because he's a quadriplegic? And he specifically, she says, is that what you're saying? And he says, yes, it is. And we know this. It's not a she said, doctor said. We know this because his wife, Melissa, recorded the conversation, and it's on YouTube, and it's a horrible demonstration of the invidious discrimination that people with disabilities face continually, elderly people, people who are chronically ill, and so forth. And I quote from it extensively in my piece at First Things, and also if people are interested in seeing the whole or listening to the whole conversation, they can do so by going to YouTube.
Where did this quality of life ethic come from?
You know, it's been brewing for some time in bioethics. Back at the time when bioethics was starting, this was back in, say, the 70s, there was kind of a fight for the heart and soul of the bioethics, what I call the bioethics movement. One of the advocates in early bioethics was Paul Ramsey. Paul Ramsey was a theologian, a devout Christian, and he said that issues dealing with public health and the challenges that we now face because of high-tech medicine must always be based on the concept of the patient as a person. In other words, the sanctity and equality of all human life. His primary opponent was Joseph Fletcher. Joseph Fletcher was a lapsed Episcopal priest who became an atheist and also was a crass utilitarian. And he posited that no, every human being should not be treated as inherently equal with other human beings, that what matters is the kind of criteria you have, what he called criteria for humanhood. And that later became personhood, because everyone is, we're talking about, is technically human, obviously. And so you have people who follow Joseph Fletcher. I call him the son of Fletcher, Peter Singer, who's the Princeton University bioethicist who says that the quality of life ethic should protect those with higher cognitive capacities and higher value over people with a lower quality of life. And in Peter Singer's thinking, sometimes even animals have greater value than humans, because if a, let's say, a chimpanzee has a greater cognitive capacity than a human being, then we should use human beings in experiments instead of chimpanzees. He once actually said that in terms in a Psychology Today interview. So you also have healthcare rationing beginning to be deployed based on a quality of life, so that people with, who are young and healthy may get treatments that people who are elderly or disabled might not. You see that in specifically in the United Kingdom with what's called the quality adjusted life year. And a lot of bioethicists in this country want to import that kind of thinking into a centralized United States healthcare system. And one final point about this, this was not a situation in which the hospital had to triage treatment for COVID patients. In other words, he was not denied medical care and shunted off into hospice when he wasn't necessarily dying, because there was no room at the inn, if you will, but because the doctor and the agency was the guardian agreed, his quality of life was not worth saving. So what they did is, instead of treating him, they put him into another room under hospice care, took away his food and fluid supplied through tube, took away his medicines, and he died 6 days later, obviously weakened by having been deprived of food and water. And if he hadn't died of the pneumonia, which took his life, within another week after that, he would have been dehydrated to death in the same manner as Terry Schiavo. It's a terrible, I would say, it's not technically criminal because it was done under color of law, but it is a immoral act that shunted a person off the lifeboat merely because he had disabilities, and it's something that should raise the hackles of every decent person.
What do you make of the doctor's statement? And again, this was recorded. You provide the transcript in some recent writing, Wesley. What do you make of his decision, or his kind of hemming and hawing as to who makes this decision? He ends up just saying it's a decision between the medical community and the state.
Right. Well, that's because of the court-appointed guardian, which was an agency. It wasn't the wife. The wife was in a fight for custody over Michael with her sister-in-law. And in the that predated this situation. And in the interim, the judge had appointed an agency to make these kinds of decisions for Michael. And the problem with that is these agents, this agency, whoever the representative was for the agency, was a stranger to Michael, a complete stranger. And often these agencies will do what the doctors recommend. So I don't, you know, I wasn't around for the discussion between the person who worked for the agency who was acting as the guardian and the doctor, but you can bet that the doctor told the person working for the agency the same things he told Melissa, the wife, only instead of fighting back the way Melissa tried to do, the agent went along with the change and said, yes, let's take away his food and water. Let's shunt him off into hospice. Let's not try to save his life.
What should we learn from this case?
Well, I think there are a few things. I put it in my piece. First off, really sign an advance directive. If Michael Hixon, before he had his cardiac arrest, had signed an advance medical directive naming his wife, Melissa, to be his decision maker, there wouldn't have been a guardianship filed in court in the first place. There wouldn't have been probably a fight with the sister, because if you listen to the tape, Melissa's very cogent. And there wouldn't have been an appointment of a temporary guardian who was a stranger to the patient. So that's important. Second, realize that the quality of life ethic is not only real, it is deadly. It takes the lives of the weak and vulnerable. A lot of disability rights activists scream and yell that this is the kind of thing they face every day, and people don't take it seriously. But if you listen to the tape, you'll see the exact kind of thing the disability rights activists righteously complain about. And finally, we have to adjust our attitudes that, and when we look at people who have difficulties and disabilities and so forth, we can't just kind of sniff, well, that life isn't worth living anymore. We have to embrace and love each and every one of us, regardless of our physical situation, our age, and so forth, as an equal. And that is something that all of us should actually redouble our efforts about.
How institutionalized has this quality of life ethic become in bioethics with hospital ethic boards and things like that?
I think it is the predominant viewpoint. It's not unanimous, but it's the predominant viewpoint. This happened in Texas, and my first thought was that this must have been one of those feudal care cases we've talked on your show before, that Texas has a law that if a doctor doesn't want to provide intensive care unit treatment, although Michael was not going to be intubated, even the wife didn't want that, then the doctor can go to a bioethics board, and the bioethics board can have it removed unilaterally, even if the patient or the patient's family or surrogate decision maker wants it. This was not a feudal care case because of that temporary guardian, but it's the same idea. The doctor specifically said that Michael's life was futile. Why was it futile? Because the doctor didn't think the life was worth living because of quadriplegia and cognitive disability. That's not futile. That is discrimination. That is bigotry. And that is something that you see running rampant in bioethics. You see pushes for healthcare rationing based on these kinds of invidious criteria. People like Ezekiel Emanuel, who was a prime architect of Obamacare and happens to be a major bioethics or a healthcare advisor for Joe Biden, believes in this kind of thing. There's article after article. If people want to go to my Google Wesley J. Smith, healthcare rationing or bioethics, quality of life, you'll see I've written article after article trying to warn people that this is coming forward. And a lot of people take the attitude, well, that can't happen here. Well, you know, if you say that anymore, you've been asleep for 50 years. Because that kind of complacency is precisely how these kinds of things come into being.
Wesley Smith is our guest, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. When we come back, we'll turn to the subject of puberty blocking. We'll talk about its ethics, but first, why is it done in the first place? What is God calling you to do? What is the one thing you were born to do? Are you truly doing what you're called to do? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or learn more about Callings for Life at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Relax in the saltwater pool surrounded by palm trees and tropical foliage. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com.
Since 1978, Lutheran Church Extension Fund has had the humble privilege of supporting Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Ministries and her workers. Thanks to faithful investors, LCEF has provided thousands of church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations with the low-cost loans and resources they need to reach more people with the saving name of Christ. To learn more, visit lcef.org or call 800-843-5233, 800-843-5233.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll continue our romp through Romans. Children of the Light, welcome the week. Forgo judgment, the kingdom of God, and whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook. Facebook.com/Luther Academy.
Bahama Mama, Ocean Pacific, Paradise Island. Retreat from the heat with a shaved ice snow cone from Tropical Snow in Caseyville, Illinois. It's right across the street from Collinsville High School. Tropical Snow is open weekdays from 1 to 9 and weekends from noon to 9. Premium Snow, epic flavors, lots of love. Tropical Snow, across the street from Collinsville High School at 2134 South Morrison Avenue in Caseyville.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the quality of life ethic in healthcare and turning to the subject of blocking puberty and the medical ethics of that. Our guest is Wesley Smith, columnist for National Review Online. These vocations in the medical community, doctors, nurses, even the ethicists, the new wave of unethical ethics would tempt Christians to abandon their posts in these vocations. But we need Christians in these vocations now more than ever. If you want to learn more about Christian vocation, whether it be in medicine or any walk of life, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is called Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose. You'll find it at our website, issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Publishing House and order Callings for Life, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Wesley, let's turn to the subject of puberty blocking. Before we discuss the ethics of it, why is it even done?
Well, as you know, the issue of transgenderism is a hot button issue today. And what has been happening in recent years is that if a child is diagnosed with gender dysphoria, meaning that a child, biological boy, will say identifies as a girl or vice versa, then the American Association of Pediatrics has actually said it is proper to, when that child is reaching puberty, to give hormones that would block normal maturation so that the secondary sex characteristics do not develop. Well, the problem with that, as I've just written in the Epoch Times, is that that's human experimentation. Even the APA and other such organizations admit they don't know the long-term consequences of doing this. There are potential side effects such as bone weakening. They don't know what will happen to brain development. So these gender dysphoric children, many of whom, by the way, change their minds by the time they reach maturity, in my opinion, are being used as human experimental subjects. They're doing these hormones have a use that has been approved by the FDA. For example, if there's a sudden too early onset of puberty, they might be given to slow that down. But this is to prevent it altogether. And in my opinion, it's become more ideology than science, because we're not stopping a physical pathology. We're really interfering with normal growth and normal maturation based on a subjective interior belief by the child. Now, many of these children are very upset, very disturbed. Some are suicidal. And, of course, they deserve love and care and embrace and acceptance and treatment, but not, in my opinion, mutilation. Good grief, Todd. Some girls as young as 13 are having mastectomies because they think they're boys. What if they reach age 18 and, as often does happen, they suddenly understand, wait a minute, I'm a girl. You've taken her breasts off. I mean, this is really horrendous stuff, and it is being pushed at the highest levels of the medical establishment as right and proper. And the ideology of the transgendered movement is such that if you try to hold up a stop sign, you're accused of being a hater and a bigot. J.K. Rowling's the author of Harry Potter has said, wait a second, I don't think this is a good idea, and has said, I don't think that sex should be misconstrued with gender, and people are trying to cancel her, you know, and have her set aside as a loathsome person. And when she's acting out of love and care for these children, as I am in writing this piece, and I would assume that the doctors who think that they should give the hormone blockers are too, but it is unethical human experimentation. We don't know what the consequences will be, and we don't know what the harms will be, and we don't know what will happen in 10, 15, or 20 years, because this is so new, and it has not been studied well in animals, and it should not be done.
So what is behind this notion that otherwise sensible medical professionals who would not try to experiment with these kind of powerful hormones in other circumstances are willing to just experiment with children's lives in this case?
I think we're in a moral panic. This is Wesley Smith on this issue, that people are so in this idea of, oh, we can't have discrimination, we have to make sure that everyone is accepted, that we have this moral panic. And I think it's, I quote a story that just appalled me out of England a little bit ago, where teachers were so caught up in this movement, this idea of transgenderism, that because they started convincing autistic kids that they were teaching that they were actually gender dysphoric. I mean, the teachers were the ones who were the moving parties to convince these mentally ill children that they were not the sex they were born. So we've seen moral panics in our country before, and I think this whole transgender stampede is one such panic. I'm not talking about what adults decide to do. That's a different issue altogether. I'm talking about children, and we should protect children from this, from having their bodies mutilated or their maturation distorted. I mean, this is supposedly reversible. I don't know. But they're also doing things after children have started to develop secondary sex characteristics where they're called, it's called medical affirmation, where they are trying to actually cause the development of sex characteristics of the opposite sex. And I saw some literature that says some of that, such as, let's say, breast development, is not reversible. And yet we're doing this to children. It is wrong. I understand that, you know, we don't want these children to commit suicide, for sure, good grief, and we want to care for them, but modifying and messing with their bodies in such a profound way should not be done.
I think another thing that we need to explore, Wesley, is that we have somehow transferred a decision like this being made by, say, an adult male to radically modify his body and change his, or at least artificially change his hormones, does not imprint onto a 7-year-old child that is not even cognitively capable of considering the consequences of these actions.
You even have bioethicists, getting back to them, and I quote in my article in Epoch Times, where this bioethicist wrote in the Journal of American Bioethics, which is not a fringe publication at all, it's a very prominent and influential bioethics journal, that parents should not have the right to block puberty blockers from being, that children should be convinced to want this, children who are gender dysphoric should be convinced by schools to want this intervention, and that parents should be prevented by the state from blocking it. Now, that's not the law now, although I do think there's some stuff happening in schools. Right now, the law is not such that parents will be prevented, but there was one case in Canada where a father was ordered to call, not to call his biological male offspring his son, but a daughter, and the judge said, if you call the boy a girl, that's going to be considered violence and abuse. Now, eventually that decision was overturned by appeals court, but that just shows you the path that we're on. And if we're not careful, not only will these children be, in my opinion, victimized, but you may have parents who want to protect their children prevented from doing so.
Where do you think it's going, Wesley?
I don't see any breaks, frankly. I mean, when people like J.K. Rowling are being viciously attacked for somehow being bigoted, and she's a very liberal on social issues, she's very in favor of gay rights, she's certainly not against transgendered people, she's saying we just need to protect children. When people like Andrew Sullivan, the writer for New York Magazine, who was one of the prime movers and shakers of the movement that led to same-sex marriage, when he says, listen, we have to keep the distinction between sex, which is something you're born with, and gender, which is something subjective, and he's being attacked, and he's one of the primary reasons we have same-sex marriage in this country, then you know that there is a stampede afoot, and people are just going to have to gird their loins and stand against it. If people are not willing to gird their loins and protect children, then there's nothing that can be done. But if we can just say, no, we're not going to yield to social fascism, perhaps this thing can be turned.
is the bioethical community, such as it is it prepared to deal with this, or do you think that it is sufficiently compromised that it is going to do whatever the winds of change say?
I think that the bioethics movement generally, of course, that not those with the modifier in front of the term bioethicist, like Catholic or pro-life, something like that, but the general mainstream people who teach at Harvard, who teach at Yale, who teach at Princeton, those kinds of people, the people who are the most prominent and the most influential have gone all in on this agenda. Not every one of them, obviously, but generally speaking, that is the direction in which they wish to take the society. And that's why I write so much about bioethics, because people, the popular media doesn't cover these issues, doesn't cover what these people are writing in their journals and discussing in symposia. But the way, in fact, there's a piece in the Wall Street Journal today or yesterday that discusses how many of these issues, it's the issue of dealing with the issues of race and statues and so forth, but how they start at the academic level and then they eventually seep down into mainstream society. That's true of bioethics as well, which is why I keep reading the journals. One of my cliches now is, if you want to find out what's going to go wrong with society in the next 10 years, read the professional journals. Isn't that a sad statement?
What does reading those journals tell you?
It tells you what the plans are for the future and how they're hatching policy and the ideology that is driving the people who are the establishment, the people who are the rule makers, the people who are the governing class, the people who are the elites. Because the average people don't go for this stuff. This is being driven from the top down, and the only way to stop it is from the bottom up.
How would you suggest... We've talked about these two stories about the tragic death of this man, really at the hands of those who should have been medically protecting him, whether he had COVID or not. And then,
that's correct. And whether he was quadriplegic or not, or whether he was cognitively disabled or not. His life should have been what mattered, not his quality of life.
You had talked about advanced directives, and that's something a person can do to protect themselves and those who are going to be making decisions in the future. What can that person who's left with those decisions to make, how can they best advocate in the face of this kind of corrupted ethical medical thinking?
Well, you can use the words of the movement against themselves. They're always talking about personal autonomy and choice. So if you fill out an advance directive and say, we'll call my wife Deborah, I filled out an advance directive, Deborah, my wife, is to be my medical decision maker. I have put down in my durable power of attorney, do not sign a living will that gives the doctor the right to make the call. Sign what in most states is called a durable power of attorney for health care. It may have a different name that allows you to name your surrogate decision maker. And this only takes effect if you become incapable of making your own decisions. And you pick somebody who shares your values. You can put down things like, I do or don't want artificially supplied food and water. I do or don't want antibiotics if I get into a certain condition and so forth. And if you do that, and if you name your decision maker, then it's going to be much harder for the doctors to be able to push you, because you can just say, I'm not accepting that. Now, let's say Michael had done that for Melissa. And if the doctor said, you know, I don't think we should provide him medical care other than hospice care because, you know, his quality of life's not going to improve, he's going to remain quadriplegic and cognitively disabled, she could have said that I don't consent to withdrawing that treatment. That is a medically appropriate treatment. It would be for anybody else, and it is also for my husband. And that would have been much harder for that doctor to countervail than it was for him to convince a stranger who often just goes along with what the doctors want, agency person who made this decision.
Finally, Wesley, with about a minute, wasn't that doctor essentially saying in the end that regardless of COVID and regardless of pneumonia or the complications from that, that this man, quadriplegic and mentally disabled, didn't deserve to live even now?
Right. No, he was saying his life wasn't worth living, and that the best thing you could do for him is to have it so that he died. And the way they made sure that happened is they took away his food and water. And he died of pneumonia because his body became so weakened because of the deprivation of food and water. But he would have died like Terry Schiavo died, slowly over 14 days, if the pneumonia hadn't gotten him first.
Wesley Smith is senior fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. He's an attorney and consultant to the Patients' Rights Council, columnist for National Review Online, and author of several books, including Culture of Death, The Age of Due Harm Medicine. You can read his columns and purchase Culture of Death on the Talk on Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. Wesley, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll continue our series, The Words of Scripture. We'll talk with Pastor Will Whedon about the word priest in the Bible. We'll discuss media coverage of religion with Terry Mattingly. And then on Thursday, we'll have Pastor Paul McCain lead us into teaching on Christ's descent into hell in the solid declaration of the Formula of Concord. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment, and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.